Hey, everybody, Shop Talk Show number 291. Dave's got a new toy he's going to tell us about. Goes on his head, holds something in his hand. It's very fancy. We're going to talk a little bit about like a component library that hopefully can stand the test of different frameworks. We're going to talk about Flip a little bit. We're going to talk about, the pattern library thing comes up a couple other times. You know, there's a really dumb bug with iframes in iOS. We're going to talk about that. And just everything in between, of course, those questions and more coming up on Shop Talk Show. This episode is brought to you in part by both Jamf and Storyblocks. Thanks too much for their support. We'll tell you what they do later in the show. For now, Mr. Day, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to a VR episode of Shop Top Shop Shop Show from the future. Chris. I'm Dave. Dave, why did I introduce myself to you?
What is I'm not up? Sure, but my best guess is that because you have a new toy that feels futuristic to you.
Oh yeah,
I had to have you explain it to me because I'm so out of the loop on stuff like this. I've played with I've had a Google Cardboard thing on my head before, or whatever. Maybe there was a different card.
I think Daydream kind of thing.
Yeah, but then there's like that's the one. Daydream is the one that's like $60 or something. That's like not cardboard. It's plastic, but you still slip your phone into it, right?
Yeah, it's a Lux cardboard. and it has a little remote control. So like you're not totally like.
Oh, okay. So that's the medium one. And then there's all kinds of expensive ones. Not all kinds of them, but there's like the Rift and stuff like that. That's what I'm most familiar with. Is there a one that's Google?
So Google does the cardboard. So they're kind of in that more casual and the Daydream, kind of more casual one-handed VR. Then there's like PSVR, which is still kind of in this range. Oculus just announced another product that's kind of in this range.
Cheap version?
Yeah, the cheap Oculus, the $200 Oculus. And then you have in the like 500-y range, you have like the, just for the kit, you still need like a $2,000 computer, but the just for the kit, like the Oculus and the Vive are kind of in that range. And then beyond that is like the Windows AR, like the hologram or whatever, HoloLens, you know? This last month with the Windows 10 update, Windows announced this thing called Windows release. They announced it last year, but the Windows mixed reality headsets.
So that's what you got. You have one.
That's what I got. And Dave is going Windows mixed reality, but and Microsoft did not give me this device.
Is it mixed reality because it's VR and AR or whatever?
Well, what's different about the Windows one is the Windows headsets start at like $299, so they're like just a shave above that you know, kind of put your phone in a box thing. But this is more like the Vive. It's got the paddles, like the full six
dock. You have to put like stuff around your room or whatever.
No, so that's why I like the Windows thing. Is it has basically it has a Kinect in it that scans your room. So like it has little cameras that like figure that out for you. You don't have to set up things in your room. You can just plug it into your computer or laptop. It works on laptops, which is kind of freaking cool. So,
but it's from Microsoft, but it has nothing to do with the. What's that, the Xbox or whatever? Or does it work with that?
No, I don't. It may eventually, but it's actually a Samsung product. So I have a Samsung Odyssey head mounted display. So, and then it has two little paddles. And then I log in, Chris, I jack into the net, as they say in Johnny Mnemonic. And I go into a little house, and I have a little house over a cliff, and I can put things into the house, and it's pretty cool. And then I can pull up a web browser, and I could go to CodePen, and I could fire up my A-frame CodePens, and then the CodePen, I click the little goggles on the A-frame CodePens, and then it goes whoop, and it like all like goes polygonal, and then all of a sudden I'm in my VR experience that I in from CodePen is now like surrounding my whole body. It's just, it's cool. I got it. I got this thing just to play with my CodePen
space. Yeah. Okay. So it's web friendly, big time.
It's web friendly, and that's why I think I like about it, because like Steam and Oculus have web browsers, but like, it is very much like first party citizen in the Windows mixed reality. And so that's why I like the web VR kind of, that's the angle I want to experiment with and play with. And it was about, I don't know, $400-ish. And
yeah,
so
yeah,
that's a lot of bucks to spend on a dumb toy, but especially if VR never takes off. But, you know, I have some Shop Talk bucks, but I also like I fixed an SSL certificate on day trip, and so I saved my company $39 a month. So
there you go. So what about paid for it, like, so. What if I want to play that the Google one with the paintbrush? Can I play that on it, or is that just
you not? Can the Windows one supports Steam VR? So anything you can get on Steam, like Google Tilt Brush and all that,
that's on Steam?
Is available. Here. Oh, no. Yeah. So that's like in the Vive stuff too. I'm sure it's on Oculus as well. Like, it's such a hot product, but
it seems like a good way to go. You can do all the web stuff you want to do and all the stuff on Steam, and it's only, it's in the hundreds, not thousands of dollars, except for the fact that you need this expensive ass computer to.
Yeah. Yeah.
What if you try to run it on like a not expensive computer? Does it just say no, or does it like,
yeah, like it does a little pre-flight check. Like when I plugged it in, it was like, You're good. Uh-oh. You know, like, it thought I didn't have USB 3, but I should. So maybe I messed something up when I was building my computer. But I've plugged it into USB 3. But yeah, no, it's cool. It's pretty darn sweet. So, and I just like the minimal setup aspect.
Yeah. And you actually do experiment with things, which I appreciate.
Yeah. Like, I'm just, the first thing I did is I brought up that whale, dude. Agile Zen whale. And, I tried to ask it some questions, but I need to, like, now that I have these like paddle things, like, I need to figure out how to make that work. But, you know, A-Frame has this thing called laser controls. But then I was like, you know, I'm going to actually change that. You have to look at the whale for like 20, 30 seconds, and then it will talk to you. That's my new, anyway, just for that pen. But
I see, for like the Zen of it all. You got to.
Yeah. Yeah. Force some Zen into the situation. So. Anyhow, this is fun. I'm going to just dork around with it. If you have web VR questions, send them to me. You know what's weird, though, is I'm in a room, a virtual reality, with a web browser that's the size of a wall, because, you know, I'm in a room and I made the web browser the size of a wall, but my web browser, the Edge, is only like 600 pixels wide or something. And I don't know if that's because it's the size of that screen inside that thing, or if it's like kind of they cheat and scale to like, you know, minimize the number of pixels they have to render or something like that. I don't know, but it's kind of interesting. Like, I have a basically planet sized browser window and it's only like 600 pixels wide. So that's a weird, hey, didn't expect that. That's why you got to test on hardware. So anyhow,
well, have happening? Fun. We'll hear.
Oh,
you know, have you seen, you know what I talk about when I say flip? I'm sure you do.
Flip. First, last, play. I don't know what I mean.
Invert.
Invert. Okay.
Yeah. Play. Because it's animation. It's about animation. It's an animation technique, I think. Paul Lewis, you know, animation guru dude, Google. Have this idea, and the idea, you know, like this is more common than flip, is the idea that the pervasive idea that in order to animate something well, you should only use like a handful of CSS properties, essentially. Like, don't use left to move something to the left. You should use transform X, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows that.
GPU accelerated.
Everybody knows that stuff. Duh. Yeah. Okay. So, but that can be kind of a pain in the ass, because translate X and left kind of mean different things. Like, left actually like moves the thing, kind of.
Yeah.
And translate X kind of doesn't.
Translate X transposes the thing based on some origin that you will never know. you'll never remember. Sarah Drasner remembers it, but she's the only person on earth that remembers it.
It is, yeah. That's another whole topic. And the thing that I just brought up, the fact that it's translate X and left are different. But imagine, let's say you wanted to, I don't know, animate something from position A to position B really smoothly. One way to do that, this kind of the flip idea, is to like calculate like where it's going first and then literally move it there with left and top and whatever way you want to get it to move there is fine. And then use a translate property to move it back to where it was before that, which is so mind-bendingly weird, right?
Okay.
Like use that. And then when you animate it to where you want it to go, you can use the translate X and Y and stuff because you're just like undoing that. You're making translate X and Y and anything else you want to do back to zero because...
Oh, okay. So like all your animations or all your translates, rotates, etc. should be going back to zero or whatever the initial state was.
Yeah.
Or like whatever the final state
is. You get like free performance out of it essentially because you're using what you want to use to animate, which is translate properties.
Let's say I go to my website and I like I want all my navigation links to plop in. Like you load up the page and it's like bloop 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 bloop. You know, something cool like that.
Sure.
And maybe there's a bounce, you know?
Of course.
So I would just actually code my navigation normally, but then I'd have an animation where like, or what? Like I'd have to like say like, all right, on
load, I don't know
load,
if it's for that animate as much minus as when you,
a million.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, you could use it for that. I think, I don't think there's anything stopping you for it, but you'd figure out what the final state is like the navigation looking normally, right? So like don't code it like that first. You should code it the off-screen way first, and then I don't even know how to think about this properly. My main point here is that this is ripe for computers to deal with this for you. Like it's such a performant way and it's just like calculate where it is and where it's going and all that stuff that this the kind of thing can be automated. And there's a David Korshid article on CSS Tricks where he made a library to do that. That I think is the whole point of this wasn't necessarily like, hey, come to my website and look at my thing. Although I always want you to do that. There's other libraries besides this one as well that do that. Cause I think a lot of people had this idea like, oh, hey bro, if this is so performant, why can't the library deal with it? And there's a number of libraries to do it for you. And I think the end result is that it's pretty sweet that you can kind of think about animation in a different way. Just like you don't have to deal with flip. It deals with it for you and you get all this animation performance for free out of it.
Yeah. Nice. Cool. Yeah.
Anyway, it's worth checking.
No, I'm very interested. They're talking about this on Wes Boss's Syntax FM.
Oh, they were
flipping out. Talking about flipping a little bit. I don't do super complex animations, so I'm wondering at what point I need this, but like a whole library to do this. But I'm gonna dig in here. So
I don't know if it's the kind of thing you sprinkle in or not. I guess it kind of depends. I would think like if I was going to set out to make a whole new UI on a new project and I knew that it was going to be thick with animation that I guess it's, you know, Valhead and Sarah's mission in life to like teach people that animation isn't this thing that you like sprinkle into interfaces to, you know, at the end kind of thing. But you're thinking, and you're not just like, this interface is going to be animated. You're like, no, interfaces are like almost always animated these days. I mean, think of using any mobile app. You click something and something slides in or it moves to the next view in some kind of animated way. And like, if you start out with that assumption that your interfaces are going to have some kind of animation between states and stuff, I probably would invest a lot of thinking into like, how are we going to implement this stuff in a systemic way?
Yeah, there was some cool Paul Lewis flip stuff, like when he was doing like page transitions, he sort of did the one where you like click that material design button, the floater button that kind of floats by your thumb, and then that turns into a whole page, you know, like,
sure,
like you click that and it like balloons out. He kind of did that for one of
the, I remember that. That was the origin of this whole technique, I think.
Yeah, 2016 Google I/O or something, 2015.
It's made its way into lots of other things, like the animating the like a menu out to its natural height. This thing can be used for that type of thing. But I think David's point here is that it's not just little things like that. It's literally anything that you need to move.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I can.
Yeah. So you move it there. You move. Okay. Oh, if on interaction. Okay. I get it. So like you click it, you move it there, and then you quickly like say like, okay, translate from the previous point to the next point. Okay. I get it. Okay.
Right. Well, there's a way to hard code this. Like if you know exactly where it's going, great. But I think the flip library does exactly what you said, is that it will figure it out on the fly quick. Like it will move it there, you know, meaning it can do something that's like more masonry, like, you know, like, okay, I see all these things are floated and something has changed that's going to relay out all these things. I'm going to just let them go there naturally, like where the float would have landed it. And then figure out, like, get all of its new coordinates and then animate it there for you. I'm sure you can all imagine a masonry-like thing. That's the same kind of idea.
Yeah, like, do all the animation. I've even seen some cool stuff on CoDrops. Like, they did, like, a list, like a product list where you click it, and then all of a sudden you're on the product view, and the, like, guitar, like, moves over. It's very, like keyed to this, like, transparent PNG product sort of situation, but it was just cool, like kind of like turning a list item into a page, because it's,
and the more of us that work on SPA single page stuff, the more that seems possible.
See, I would be curious how that single page works, you know, I mean, because like you basically go from like product item to like in a React world, but like product detail, you know, like element, like you're going from different elements, you're not going from different, you know, but maybe somebody has all this figured out. So
I like the sentiment that, have you seen that, like, now that we've gone down this road, that if there was a native browser way to handle transitions between pages, not in a single page app, but literally like let the page refresh old school style, but still have there be some native web way to animate between things that are happening, like a on before unload, but with animation.
Yeah, there, Chrome had that for a little bit.
Like, I know, and then it went away, and now it's like, or maybe it didn't go away, but it certainly didn't get popular. And now it's no kind of back.
Browsers. Well, it should come back. If you're on the Twitters, Chrome is doing a like, hey, we need some high level features, because they're noticing people are shipping a butt ton of JavaScript just to do the same things over and over and over, like a hamburger menu or like, you know, whatever. Like, and so I think they're kind of like, oh, we probably need to pave some cow paths or something like that. But there's basically like, what high level features do you want in Chrome? And I don't know if it's smart to open that up to the whole world, because you'll get a bunch of random requests, but you know, stuff like this would be helpful. I mean, I feel like a lot of people reach for JS frameworks just for that sweet page transition. You know, it's kind of a shame. So, or that's just a lot of JavaScript just to make.
Oh, no, and there's people that are making the choice to go SPA just for that, which is maybe that's not a good enough reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it would be cool if that was not the only option, is how I'm saying it. So,
this episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Storyblok. Storyblok is a one-stop shop for all your stock media needs at extremely high value. Like, there's hundreds of thousands of things in Storyblok. That's videos, audio tracks, and of course, images. Hundreds of thousands. It's great. All super high quality stuff for a fraction of the cost that you'd find it other places. So that's the idea. It's pretty affordable. It's great. How often are you looking for some of this stuff? For me, it's all the time. All the time I'm looking for like a perfect image for a social media thing, or I'm working on a landing page that I need a nice hero image for, or I'm working on just the UI for an app and need to work on that, or really commonly I'm working on a blog post that I could use good imagery for. As a front-end developer or web designer, it's all the time you're looking for stock stuff. I think it makes you a better designer to have this type of stuff, like a place where you can go and know that you're going to find good stuff. So storyblocks.com/shoptalk for all your stock images, footage, and audio, all you can imagine. And how about this? This is pretty cool. 100% of the revenue from the sales go directly to the artists. So you can feel good about it. It's like you're getting what you need. The artists that are creating this are getting what they need. Pretty fantastic. Check out storyblocks.com/shoptalk. Here's a good quote to change gears a little bit. This is a David Gasparoni said in this. This is a couple months ago. The Atlantic posted a piece called Saving the World from Code that was really good. I think a lot of us read it, but it was apparently connected it to something we had said about justifying bugs in software or something. I don't even remember exactly which episode he was quoting from example, but it's worth reading a quote from it. I think that's just interesting just for anybody to hear. This is from the article. This is the trouble with making things out of code as opposed to something physical. The complexity, Levinson puts it, is invisible to the eye, which is true, right? Use a website and you have no idea what complications are behind the scenes. For Lamport, the major reason today's software is so full of bugs is that programmers jump straight into writing code. Architects draw detailed plans before a brick is laid or a nail is hammered, he wrote in the article. But few programmers write even a rough sketch of what their programs will do before they start coding.
This taps into my why we should all be prototyping philosophy.
Sounds like a book.
Sounds like a book. A part. It sounds like a book y'all should buy from my website, which I don't actually sell. But no, I think about this architect stuff a lot. It's like, you know, even VR and stuff is helping architects like figure out spaces before they even order a piece of wood or lumber. You know, they're able to visualize things at room scale, or they're able to like build those scale models, you know, to see if this is all fitting together how they expected. I think that's really important, you know. I think that's really important to do in you know, detailed plans, like they're saying. Like I think we're I don't know. At some point, you don't need detailed plans. Maybe, you know, I don't know. Like the Amish probably aren't like when they go to raise the next barn, they're not like, oh man, we'll have to like hire, you know, Jebediah to like, you know, draft up some plans for the next 12 years and then we'll have the barn ready. You know, they kind of have like a barn footprint or a barn template that they kind of use. So I think at some point you probably, like, if you know what you're building, like you'd need less of a plan, but you know, if you're building something big and new, you probably need to make a good big plan. So. Or at least a prototype of your idea.
Yes. So, I whiteboarded something this morning. Does that count?
That counts. Whiteboards are good. I think whiteboards, you know, this is a thing too. Sketching is also prototyping. You know, blogging can be prototyping because you're just like hashing this idea out and it's in a visible space where other people can see it, hopefully, and provide feedback, you know, like. You can probably, if you whiteboard it out like a new flow or something for CodePen, you know, I know Tim's in your office. He could probably spot that and be like, oh, that's a problem because we actually don't have like an API endpoint for this little part of your flow. Yeah. And that's like 12 months of work. And then you're like, oh, I didn't know that. You know, okay. Like, like
that makes me sad actually in a way, because it means that I think it's a minor strike against remote work, which I hate to admit, but I don't, maybe that's not true. Maybe it's like a strike against poor remote work. And yeah, it's something we're trying to fix too, because we have, I don't know, some new stuff, but I'm starting to, you know, like, wow, this is really nice being in the same office with someone. We're fixing things a lot faster and things move ahead and communication is more fluid and yada, yada, yada. It doesn't have to be that way. I think it means that remote work, you have to be really, because I think you just get it for free when you're in the same office. And then to replicate that quality remotely, you need to be much more, you have to force it.
Yeah. I mean, you also, there's like an inverse burn too. I mean, you probably have a little bit longer lunches and, you know, right. Maybe yeah. You accidentally all watched a YouTube series for like four days, you know, like there's other problems, but no, I mean, when Paravel, we get together, it's like almost always sketching. Like we just sketch out things like we mostly work apart and we all live in Austin. We all live 10 minutes away from each other. But like, you know, when we need to like make a thing happen, like start a project or kind of get into idea building or whatever, we'll get together and we'll do a lot of sketching and like a lot of our projects. I found
that to be the same way in that our founder get togethers or even all teams, sometimes in the early days, we're like, let's get together and we'll get so much work done. Cause we'll crack our laptops and we'll be right there. We can talk things out and we're blasting code. And then that became laughable. Like, no, we're not going to do that. But planning wise has to be like that. So we can't fire up a Zoom call and actually do planning because we'll all get bored and distracted and it doesn't work. So we get together for planning and that type of high level stuff. And also set the bar saying like, we're not going to write any code this week because it ain't going to happen. So it's in-person is great for that. That's different than day-to-day work.
Yeah, but I think for those planning cycles, it's important to be together as best you can, you know, but also like foster a habit of, you know, doing the dumb thing where you just say, hey, we're talking about this just so we're on the same page. I'm going to sketch this out. Take out my phone, take a picture and post that in Slack. I mean, like we do that all the time. Like most of our Slack is just photos of shitty sketches.
Yeah.
Like, so
have you seen that? Like, isn't there like some startup that like makes a whiteboard that can send you a PDF of what's on the whiteboard?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm about to like throw my HP printer scanner all in one inkjet blaster into the garbage because it's bad. But also because I have a phone, I can take a picture with the phone and then it's basically scanned. It's as good as scanned. There's apps that'll like crop that out. And then, you know, like why would I need a giant?
I saw thing? There's a new industry that has copied that business model. I happen to know in Oregon, there's dispensaries here, you know, legal marijuana. Uh-huh. And one of them sells this little like smoker device that like is like $20, right? Like a printer, you know, you go to Best Buy and the printer's $20 and the printer cartridge is $100 or whatever. It's the same deal. The little cartridges you put it in are $55.
Whoa, dude. So
they copy the weed worst.
Is inkjet of like
legal weed is
inkjet of drugs.
Only if you go, I mean, there's different ways to cut legal weed, but in this case, yeah,
it's inkjet for drugs.
And golly, it's got a Bluetooth app to your phone. I just heard somebody say
that. My printer has a Bluetooth app or whatever. It's awful. Oh, man.
Let's do a real question.
All right, here we go. Thank you. That was great, David. Here we go. James writes in, how do you go about creating framework agnostic view components for a pattern library for consistency's sake? Exclamation question. Hey, guys, I just started a new job as senior UI engineer. I came from a place where I helped develop a pattern library with components, date picker, table, multi-picker, that were based on Knockout because that's what we used with little to no chance of changing. However, at the new place, there's talk of a different JS library than is currently in the product. If this pattern continues, the JS library will change in a few months, years, etc. How do we go about creating a pattern library for front end with varying frameworks? Is it HTML, CSS only, and we don't include JS, or do the components use vanilla JS? Thanks for the show.
I love this question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the answer to that is like not the world isn't ready for it yet, but it's close. it doesn't even seem like it's been in the water lately. Like, oh my God, there's so many JavaScript frameworks. There's web components. Like, can't we all get along kind of thing? And that hasn't totally shaken out yet. But I would suspect in like 6 months or a year, it will have. And there will be like a way to make components. It seems to me that going the web nativist way you possibly can will help you. That's the way to go.
Yeah. You know, Jason Miller from Preactlandia? Mm-hmm. Preact. He's kind of been tweeting or showing little snippets of basically a component transpiler. Like, I don't know if it's like a Babel transform for components, but you basically put your React component in and you're like, give me an Angular one.
The fact like, that exists and is possible to write means that we should just standardize it. If it doesn't matter, if it can just be instantly transpiled by some code, then why are they different at all?
No, for sure. Well, and that's, I think like the, you know, I think this is where web components comes in. And the dream of web components is you just write once, it works everywhere. But let's just take the optimism out of that. The dream of web components is that, you know, component A is compatible with component B. So I think if you wrote in a low level, like web component way, I think it's going to be easy to start transpiling that into something else, whether that's through a transpiler or like a manual refactor, like keep your code as dumb as possible. I do know people who are doing the HTML CSS only route.
Sure. Like what if you used Fractal? Have you used that?
Fractal is like big deal. Like everyone loves Fractal right now.
I want to try it, but I've never actually given a, is it a competitor, would you say, to Atomic, whatever?
Yeah, it would be like a competitor to the Pattern Lab like product. But Pattern Lab, what's cool about Pattern Lab is they chose Mustache as the vehicle.
And it looks like Fractal chose nothing in a way.
I don't know enough. I thought they kind of like let you do a few different things or like handlebars-y or something, but I actually don't know, so I don't want to comment too deeply. But the Pattern Lab uses, and this is demo.patternlab.io, uses Mustache to kind of power things. So it's in Mustache is a logicless template system, or it has a little bit of logic, like maybe if statements and stuff like that. Maybe it doesn't even have logic. So it's a logicless template system. So it's basically just for spitting out data. Now, if you have logic in your
handlebars.
Oh, it's handlebars now? Sorry.
No, in Fractal, I guess.
Oh, okay. So
in curly brackets.
Curly brackets. And so almost any, you know, PHP, Java, whatever, like anything has a curly bracket syntax, you know, to convert to Rails or Liquid, you change the curly brackets to like bracket, you know, equals or bracket. Sure. Percent sign. I'm a fan of like very like generic templates that can be easily like basically recoded in something else. Like think about like what's the find and replace flow for this component to get into mystery framework, you know? So you want to make your components kind of as dumb as possible, but there are things like accordions and tabs and those kind
of, you did that in this way, even in either one of these, if you chose, or one of the million other ones I'm sure are out there, that's not a Preact component or a React component or an Angular component or anything. They're it's not the right format. So now you're managing it twice or what? Or do you have some kind of weird build step in between that converts them or something?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's sort of like a manual integration. I mean, so like
that's not going to last.
No, it's not. But eventually, like you're eventually going to have something in production that you can use, and then
which isn't that why Storybook is popular and stuff like that? Because it is the right component.
Yeah, Storybook is cool because it basically consumes your React components and you.
Like it's Vue as well.
Yeah, it does Vue, or there's a Vue branch and probably a few others, but it sucks up your components, and then you can provide stories, which are basically like little state modules or themes or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the red button story. This is the blue button story for our button component. I think that's super cool. I think like that metaphor is actually really great, especially if you work in enterprise and they love to like, let's get a user story for this or whatever. It's like, yep, here's all the stories. You know, we're using the same language. So I think that's
Going to be cool. More useful today. I would think storybook is the way to go today if you're working in like a Reactor View environment or whatever. But James is literally saying this stuff changes. So yeah, so is storybook going to change with it, or is it better to go web component kind of way? Because web components, they might change and stuff, but not drastically. Like, it's part of the web, and the web doesn't just like up and change overnight, you know?
Yeah, there's like a I wish I knew the website offhand. There's like a web component, like here we go. I'm blanking. There's a website that tracks like how compatible a framework is with web components.
Oh, really?
Do you know that website?
No, I don't, but I like that idea. I should also say that part of the React docs from day one said like the idea of web components and React are not mutually exclusive. You can have a web component that uses React to do all the state stuff. You totally can. So like, that seems like an undertold story as well.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to figure out what the... I wish I knew this, Chris. It's driving me nuts. So Rob Dodson, it's in his wheelhouse. I think he manages the site. But it's basically a, like, is, you know, is Preact web component compatible? And it's like a score of, like, 24 out of 30 or something like that, but they're working to like build it up to 100%. And there's, you know, different things like whatchamacallit. React is a little low scoring just because, you know, React sort of does things differently. They're kind of making their own component system.
Well, they'll be the least likely to.
Yeah. Well, cause you know, The big deal, I think, with React is it also has like native compile targets like iOS or React Native and all that. So I think it's just a little different setup. So, yeah, I don't but it could also be great. You know, like maybe somebody's going to do a PR and it gets fixed overnight. You know, that stuff can happen because it's open source, you know, so. I'm going to.
That was a fun conversation. Let's talk about something else now.
I'm like 400 tabs into trying to find this dumb website. So yeah, I'll let you read the next question, and then after you read that question, I will chime in with the
correct nothing makes URL good radio like question. Like live Googling. That's the best.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Ben Foster writes in. Hi, Ben. My question is about iframe scrolling. Putting aside the argument on whether it's good or bad to use iframes at all, there are some situations where you don't have a choice. I have content that needs to scroll inside an iframe. This seems to work everywhere, as expected, except on iOS. I've tried every trick I can find to get this to work on iOS, including adding the scrolling attribute to the iframe, wrapper divs, and applying web hit overflow scrolling touch CSS property to the parent, but nothing seems to work. Fixed position elements break, viewport units are incorrectly calculated, and scrolling is generally janky. Do you have any experience with dealing with scrolling iframes on iOS? I do. You know?
Yeah, no, I guess, yeah, the CodePen's 100% iframes. So, how do you do that, Chris?
It's a mess. I mean, it's, there is no great solution to it. I hate to tell you, Ben.
It's not hardware accelerated, right? Like, or it's not the smooth scrolling when you have an iframe. Is that right?
I think that's maybe fixed. I think that used to be true.
Okay.
The worst part is exactly what he said, that the scroll ability to it, like tell me this isn't just nuts, but this is the truth as best as I know. And I think I know.
Mm-hmm.
If you put an iframe in iOS to some source, any source, it will just grow in height to be whatever the size of the content inside that iframe is. You have no choice. If you, with CSS, you try to force it to be some other height, too bad. You put the height attribute on the iframe itself, too bad. it literally ignores you and will make the height of that iframe the height of the content inside. That seems crazy, but it seems to be the truth to me. And what's weird about that is that's actually kind of hard to do if you want it to behave like that. You can't do that on desktop. If you ask doing that on desktop is very hard. You have to like measure the internal height of the iframe and then have it like post message back out how tall it is and then change the iframe on the outside to be the height. It's like a pain in the butt. It's like a difficult thing to do. On iOS, for some reason, it just does it.
What? So, hey, why does it do the thing you want? So it does the thing you want on desktop, but you kind of don't want?
You don't want that on mobile because, so let's say you have a page that's, you know, 5,000 pixels tall. You don't get any scroll events because it doesn't scroll. It doesn't need to. It's as tall as it needs to be. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. so there it throws no scroll events. All your fixed positioning stuff is all broken. All the get position stuff you do that you assume needs to happen because of the viewport. Well, the viewport is the size of the entire document. So it's all wrong. You know, it's so weird. The only way you can get scrolling is like Ben said, to put it inside of a div, which you can control the height of, and then put scrolling on that div. And as long as the div has like no styling or whatever, it seems to work fine. Then you can, at least you can scroll up and down and control the height, which you often need to do. But that's all you can do. You still don't get the scroll events. The fixed positioning is still all screwed up. I mean, there's just nothing to do. It's broken and that's that. I've raised the bug. I've talked about it. I don't even know why it is like that. Even I would be happy with even knowing why it's like that.
That seems so aggressive, like weird, right?
Yeah. And I don't know why it's not a bigger deal. I guess that there's just not a ton of use cases. Seems like Ben and me are having this problem.
Two people on this planet.
We just got it. I think we have a text expander in CodePen support because it doesn't, you know, like on desktop, it's fine, you know, and not everybody in the world needs scroll events in their pens and then also needs to test those same scroll events on iOS, you know? So it's like a subset of people that care about this. But we often have to say, don't use debug mode in CodePen, you know, because that'll work fine because then there's no iframe involved. But anything that's through an iframe, like our live view or the editor itself on iOS, has this problem.
You know what's happening? You know, I got a story about this.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to show a CodePen of a VR thing, and I was in the, I think I was in the full view, right?
Sure, which is an iframe.
Full screen, but it should be the
Your VW and VH units, those are all screwed up. I'm just trying to guess where it's going.
Well, the gyroscope doesn't work. So I'd like it say like, oh, you need to tilt your phone, you know, because like it picked that part up, and then I'd tilt my phone and then the scene would just be messed up and uninteractive. So like the gyroscope inside an iframe quit working. And I think they maybe did that for like ads because they were using that to like stalk you basically or something like that. So maybe they disabled that, but like, yeah, like a gyroscope in an iframe on iOS doesn't work, of course.
Like, I don't know, I think that's related to the iframe height as well, or even if it's not, it's still a weird bug thing.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be the iframe height, but I think it could also be like people were using that to like try to ads were trying to figure it out if you like had your phone like. If you're like walking or laying down or something, or, you know, all those like weird things, ads people try to do. So, it was kind of just sort of, kind of spooky or weird. So,
well, that's fun. Sorry, we don't have something better for you, Mr. Ben. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Jamf Now. For some people, IT is a task and not a career. Certainly, that's how it is at my small business, is that, of course, we have to do IT. It's somebody's task, but we don't have like a full-time IT person. Of course, Jamf Now can help you manage and secure your Apple devices at work. For example, when your business is first starting out, it's pretty easy to keep track of a couple of MacBooks, a couple of iPhones. But as the company grows and you start to buy more and more tech for your employees, it gets harder to keep track of everybody's iMac and iPhone and iPad and all your iStuff. Figuring out how to secure an iPad that an employee lost, for example, can be tough, especially if you're all remote in different locations. Jamf Now makes that and much more easy. You check real-time inventory. You can configure the Wi-Fi, all the email setup. You can deploy apps. You can protect sensitive company data. You can even lock or wipe a device from anywhere. Jamf now secures your devices so you can focus on your business instead. No IT experience needed. Shop Talk Show listeners, listen up. You can start securing your devices today. Manage your first 3 devices for free. And then as you add more devices, it's just $2 per device per month. Create your free account today. That's Jamf, JAMF.com/ShopTalk.
Just want to update people on my live Googling. I still have not found this, so
I've never even seen it. I don't think it exists. Throw down the gauntlet. And to remind our audience, if you're just listening in, Dave is looking for some kind of website that tracks whether how compatible web components are with different framework style of components, right?
Yes. And I'm very close. I'm hot on the trail, and nothing is coming up. So anyway, let's keep going. Chris, next question.
Sure. Let's see. Steve Polito writes in, doing a lot of work with Drupal and WordPress, building small, medium-sized sites. Steve's saying, I don't need to use a lot of JavaScript in my day-to-day work. Okay, cool. I just started a new project, though, that does have a good use case for JavaScript. My client is...
Bing, bing, breaking news. Bing, ding, 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 ding,
oh,
ding,
you're good. Okay.
Okay, it's called Custom Elements Everywhere. Custom-elements-everywhere.com. And it's basically, you know, how well do these things support custom elements, which is kind of the foundation for like web components themselves.
It is. I bet this is website has been updated recently. I saw a tweet just the other day, and it was a cool Twitter account that I didn't know about, but it's at Intent to Ship. And Gecko says, Intent to Ship, custom elements.
Uh-oh.
So that's nice. Good news for this website anyway.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, we're turning out our previous broadcast shop talk.
Angular 5.0.2 score. 100%.
Yep.
That's pretty cool. Yep. Well, how's React doing? 71%. Preact, 91%. So, this is fascinating.
Vue, 100.
It is a Rob Hundo. Dodson. It's not even in his wheelhouse. He literally made this site.
Yep. This is him. Why did I not find this using all my Google power? Anyway.
Well, I'll link to it so it'll, you know, give it a little SEO.
Yeah. All right, we'll get the SEO happening.
So Steve was saying that he works on, you know, CMSs like Drupal and WordPress and doesn't use a lot of JavaScript, but this new project he's on has a great use case for JavaScript. This client is looking to parse some data from an external JSON file and display the data on their site. Sure. Classic, you know, Ajax, get some data, do something with it. That's the world a lot of us live in all the time. So let's assume that I don't have access to the headers on that external source where the JSON is. When I try to parse the data from, for example, externalsource.com/data using Ajax and JSON.parse, I get CORS issues. No control allow origin present on the requested resource. So you can't. You can't just Ajax for that JSON data and do something with it because there's cross-origin issues there. So that's a classic issue. I would think if it's like a business thing, maybe the correct answer is like, can you get them to change their headers? I mean, come on. But if not, what are the ways around it? Dave, there's at least a couple.
You go first.
There's JSONP, but that requires their cooperation as well. JSONP, like instead of just being JSON data, wraps that JSON data in a function call. And it's just some trickery to get around it, and that it will call that callback function then, and it's just like a way around CORS kind of. But I think it requires them to format the data as JSONP then, and they may or may not be doing that. And then the way around it, if you absolutely have no cooperation from them at all, which is weird because like, why are they spitting out JSON if people can't digest it? Like, that seems bizarre. Like, they need to just fix the issue. Would be to some kind of server side middleman do a little serverless thing that can pull that data in, and spit it back out to you on your own server.
With the right core settings.
With the right core settings. Yeah. Or if it's on your own site, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, this is functionless or whatever. Like, that's probably a great, or functionless, serverless, or functional.
Dude, next year, I'm all about serverless. It's my whole thing. I've decided. I think serverless is the coolest thing. And it's not just for little stuff like this. It's just for like, oh my God, you know, we can take that front end skill set and just blow it out.
Well, so we should talk about that, because
we should.
Workers are like web workers, which have great support across all browsers, are also like available. And it's basically serverless on the client side. You know what I mean? Like you're basically like, offload this little function thing, do this all on another worker, and then get back to me, which is just like,
I think that would solve cores, but it will solve a lot of other interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's just, it's almost exactly like serverless, but it's on the client. Isn't that funny? Anyway, I'm kind of want to like explore that. I just never know when to like split those out, but yeah, there's actually, I've used websites to get around this before, like temporarily or whatever, like, but then like you hit API limits and you, everyone gets mad, and, you know, also you're like basically like telling a third party, hey, suck up this data, and who knows what they're doing with that. I get a little heebie-jeebie about it, but I would honestly try like a,
remember cores everywhere? So Dave's like, cores where appropriate. You're not a cores everywhere kind of guy.
No. I'm cores everywhere, I think. But I think with APIs, like, it makes sense to like lock it down, you know, like to the servers your API wants to talk to. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like if it's okay. So if it's an API, I don't know, like, if that's at odds with the cores everywhere philosophy or not. I probably would, like, I don't know. Like, if, like, we've been talking about an API code pen forever. Like, it's feeling a little bit closer, but I don't know. No promises, of course, right? But you can imagine a conversation like that. Like, why isn't, like, just a user on CodePen have an endpoint? Like, Chris Coyer, like, codepen.io/Chris Coyer is my user profile. Why isn't Chris Coyer.json that same data, but JSON'd up so you could access it and stuff? I would think we would turn cores headers on for that, because you want to digest that, you should be able to digest that from wherever the heck you want to, which is an API. But then it's like, what is there other API stuff that's a little more sensitive that maybe we would turn on, like access type stuff too? I don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, your public and your private ones are different, you know, like,
yeah, maybe if you're authed as yourself, then you can have private stuff, or maybe you need an API key for this other type of things, because we need to, like, and then some stuff is rate limited, and I don't know, APIs are a whole discussion.
So anyway, I guess we're not helping Steve a whole bunch here.
You need a middleman is what you need.
You need a middleman, and it's probably just like, you know, if you think of it like a PHP file,
which he's working in WordPress. Drupal. Yeah. Just make a little like route. It's like,
yeah,
get data.
Yeah. Make a get data page, and it calls a function, and it's like curl the URL, and then response.json.
I think WordPress even has the helper function just for this. So you could make it.
Oh, really?
I think so. Doesn't it? Like WordPress, I'm going to live Google it, get remote data or something.
Workaround.
WP remote git, which is just it's probably just a curl wrapper, but with a probably WordPressy looking API to it, you know.
Beautiful.
Does have that. I'm not, yeah.
Oh, yeah, nice. And so it'll like set the headers and all that to what it needs to be. So there you go. Hey, that's good.
There you go, Steve. Use that. Or you know what? Maybe you don't even need to do it with JavaScript at all. If you're doing this on the server side, maybe just get the data server side. And I would highly recommend that if you do that, you do it in the code, but you also set a transient, which is WordPress's like internal caching thing to do this. Yeah. I do this with a number of things in WordPress, even live on CSS Tricks right now. I'll like get the job feed over JSON, but I'll chuck it in a transient so that the next page request, it doesn't have to hit the network. You don't want every page request to hit the network for what will probably be the same data for hours and hours and hours, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. People will notice spikes and things will fall over.
It's just not good for perf
traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We should probably quit.
Hey, yeah, let's get out of here. I think that was a good question. It's unfortunate. I wish I had a better answer than like you have to like code a thing. So, anyway, all right. Well, hey, Chris, this has been a fun episode. And we should say a little bit of housekeeping. We are starting to wrap up this season, this year of Shop Talk shows. We are continuing on for like season 6 or something freaking incredible. And we're approaching episode 300 next year, but we're going to do this episode and probably one more. And then we're off for Christmas. We got babies and vacations and all that. So we will be out for the holidays. So I appreciate everyone, downloading this but you know, hey, well, it'll be worth it, and we're going to 300. So it's fun. So and beyond. So all right. So that said, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. People want to hire people like you. Follow us on Twitter @shoptalkshow for tens of tweets a month. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.